Welcome. This is David Cross from Bowtie Tours, and today we are chasing history. Before we get started, I want to talk to you about the Great Courses series, though. This is an organization that has been giving us the best lectures about myriads of subjects for years. I love the Great Courses series. I love their courses on music. I love their courses on religion. I have courses on the American Civil War, on the Constitution. I have them on specifically one on Abraham Lincoln, Jesus and his Jewish influences, a lot of different lectures. And I have, through the years, found many of them to be interesting. The great trials of world history and the lessons they teach us. These are the best teachers in the world. And listening to them, they're usually half-hour lectures. They can go straight onto your computer, straight onto your cell phone, and you can listen to them on the way to work. And I cannot possibly recommend them too strongly. They are wonderful lectures. I am speaking to you from the very, very cold world of Philadelphia. It's the end of 2017, so we're going to have a different kind of episode than we usually have. Next year, we're going to get started really jumping into the substance, discussing the George Washington series. We're going to get back to the George Washington series, and we're going to discuss the Civil War as well. So we have a lot of interest that's coming up next year. And today I'm doing an episode really regarding, well, what's happened this year in terms of Civil War and comments and statues and all of that. And I call this where I'm coming from. And the reason is I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction of myself and where I'm going to be coming from as I discuss the Civil War during the next year. Now, you may say, I don't care where you're coming from. Okay, I understand. You can go straight to the next episode. It's not something I would usually do. I do it in this circumstance because the Civil War is a very different kind of thing. And the Civil War is one of those subjects where a lot of people do want to know where you're coming from. When I get a phone call and people are interested in my Gettysburg tour, which I do with the great Wilson Dorwood, he's our main military expert here at Bowtie Tours, but when somebody wants to know where I'm from, they want to know what perspective is going to be given in the tour. And, well, you know, my answer is always quite clear. If they're from the South, I'm from the South. And if they're from the North, I'm from the North. It's not really a lie. I am from both places. And I love both places. And throughout my life, I have felt kind of torn between the North and the South, the things that I like about each. So you know, I'm not really lying. You tell me you're from the South, and I can tell you that I'm from the South because I grew up in Virginia. I grew up in Northern Virginia. Now, those of you who know Virginia know that Northern Virginia is a very different place from Southern Virginia. However, I went to Jeb Stuart High School, a high school whose name finally was changed just this year to Justice High School. Jeb Stuart High School was named, I have to say, not because people felt this close connection to Jeb Stuart or their ancestors or anything like that. Really, I lived in a suburb of Washington, D.C., but quite frankly, it was named as a message to those people who would integrate our schools in the late 50s and early 60s. It was named very specifically to make people of a certain background uncomfortable. You know, it's been a interesting year when we talk about the Civil War, because a lot of people have jumped into discussing the Civil War. And as we look at our country today, it almost feels like that war never ended. We have a president who wants to know good enough question, why couldn't this all have been avoided? We have leading politicians who say, well, the reason it wasn't avoided, it was just a failure to compromise. So I'm going to talk about those two things, but let me begin with a description of myself and where I'm coming from. You know, the Civil War, as I say, it's interesting because it has such adherence to differing sides and views. It's this war where every battlefield has two different names. The two books that I'm using as my most fundamental texts kind of reflect this schism, because one of them is by James M. McPherson. It's called Battle Cry of Freedom, The Civil War Era. Some of you out there may have read this book in college. It's a pretty basic treatise, a very good book. But if it's criticized, it's always criticized by those who say it shows a northern bent. The other book that I use as my major source is the Shelby Foote three-volume treatise called The Civil War. And if people have a problem with that book, it's that it comes from a southern bent. Now, both of these people, I think, are very good scholars. Both of these people are not firebrands. They're not selling alternate facts, fake reality, trying to just create stories to bolster their own beliefs or their father's beliefs or their grandfather's beliefs or their great-grandfather's beliefs or their mother's beliefs or their you get the idea. However, they do come from different perspectives. It's interesting that Battle Cry of Freedom goes through the period leading to the Civil War in order to really discuss the country and to discuss the very many attempts at reconciliation, the numerous attempts at compromise that were made. Whereas Shelby Foote's pretty much begins with Jefferson Davis withdrawing from the Congress and with the war beginning. And Shelby Foote's, I think, is a little more geared towards the battle enthusiast, and McPherson's is a little more geared toward the politics of the event. I just recently purchased the four-volume Robert E. Lee set by Douglas Southall Freeman, and he doesn't call it the Civil War. It's the war between the states. And hopefully I'll get a chance to go back and talk about that a little bit as we discuss Robert E. Lee. Been a lot of disturbance this year. And of course, I'm talking about Charlottesville, Virginia. I'm talking about the people who stood up to defend the statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, Virginia, against being taken down. And that was one of many stories that we heard this year. We heard of people in UVA arguing that Thomas Jefferson should not be quoted in that school because even though he founded the school, that he shouldn't be quoted because he was a slaveholder. We saw that in the Woodrow Wilson School at Rutgers, is it? That people wanted to change the name because Woodrow Wilson had racist tendencies. The President of the United States jumped into it. Other people have discussed it. People have been injured. Lady was killed in Charlottesville when somebody drove a vehicle into a mass of people who were there, and it was a scene that harkens to the many scenes we've seen around the world with terrorists doing this. And it seems that we're in a very heightened state about all of this, and it makes me very sad because I love history. And my fear is that people are going to be scared to care about history or study history. You know, there was a stories, I don't know how true they were, but there were stories that people were going to show up and try to create disturbances at the Gettysburg reenactment this year. I don't really understand that. Yeah, there are going to be people there dressed in Southern uniforms, just as there are going to be people there dressed in Northern uniforms. We're in a crisis in terms of our knowledge of American history, and anything that's going to be make people even less willing to go learn about history or involve themselves in history is, I think, a real bad and scary thing. At the same time, I can hear what each of these sides is saying sometimes. You know, I saw those films of the people over at Charlottesville, Virginia. And let me say that I know people who revere Robert E. Lee. I went to Washington and Lee Law School, and that was a college where they absolutely revere Robert E. Lee, and they follow his honor code, and he's buried there, of course. He's got statues throughout the school. Of course, it's a private school. I think it's a very different issue when we're discussing statues in private places as opposed to public places. But in any event, I know people from the South. I know people who revere Robert E. Lee. And the people I saw in the films, I don't think were those people. I think if you asked them questions about Robert E. Lee, they wouldn't have known it. They looked like people who wanted to show up and who wanted to cause trouble. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe there's some great, you know, Southern Confederate history experts in there. Probably there were some. But for the most part, that's not what I saw. It's an issue of great polarization, and I have people come to me who say, well, and this is the same phrase I hear every time this is discussed, I hear, well, you can't change history, as in, these Southerners shouldn't, the statues should not be taken down because they're a part of history. And I think the analysis has to go a little deeper than that. Statues are about today. Statues are about who we choose to celebrate. And we have to go into this with that understanding. You know, we don't have a statue of Benedict Arnold. It's not that we're denying he existed. We know he existed. We read books about him. We're taught about him in school. We just don't celebrate him. So nobody's trying to change history. What I'm more concerned about in terms of changing history is that, according to polls, 70% of the American public don't think that the Civil War was about slavery. So really, the history has been changed in a lot of ways. Because, yeah, you can call it states' rights, and we'll be discussing these things through the next several weeks. But in the middle of this whole cauldron of anger between the North and the South back then was slavery. That was the thing, as we'll hear, that Lincoln threatened to mess with. Not that he was going to even take a slave away from the South, but that he was not going to allow any further states to come in and be slave states. And that, of course, would alter the balance of power, and the Southerners felt eventually would end up in having their slaves taken away from them. So to say it's not about slavery is, I think, a confusion of what our history is. You know, we can revere our ancestors without agreeing with the cause that they may have found themselves fighting. And, of course, a lot of people in the South were fighting because the North was at the South. And so they said, well, this is my home, and I'm going to fight to defend it. Just like any other war, I mean, if we have a war for big oil, it doesn't mean all the people fighting have stock in oil companies. It's brought up many times that most of the people who fought on the Southern side had no slaves and really had no interest in slaves, and that's true. But that doesn't mean the war was not about slavery. One of my earliest memories as a child is when my father took me out to Arlington Cemetery, and I purchased a photograph of Robert E. Lee. I was pretty little. I don't know if I knew that Robert E. Lee and the South was in a war against the North involving slavery. I think I probably did. But I know that I found this picture to be very kind of reassuring, this individual. He looked so calm. He looked so secure. He looked so in control. And he's standing there, and he's holding his hat, and he just has this expression. You know, I love the early photographs of our political leaders and presidents when the cameras first started happening. I love the photograph of John Quincy Adams that they have. It's kind of a delight to switch over from people we can only see in paintings and see how they actually look. And I am fascinated by photographs of people from that period. I'm fascinated to look into the eyes of Robert E. Lee or Ulysses Grant, John Brown. You know, this is a period where we get to start to really learn from the photographs. Of course, the photographs of the battlefield that were splashed across the newspapers after Gettysburg, after Antietam, people waking up in the mornings and seeing the carnage of this new kind of war with this ridiculous amount of casualties, this ridiculously high percentage of casualties. But at any event, I knew I was from Virginia. I know I knew that. And I know that it was a picture that really had a kind of an intense effect on me. When I went to college, first I went out to Boston. I went to Berklee School of Music. And then I transferred to Virginia Commonwealth University. And I actually lived on Monument Avenue. And I lived in front of or to the side of the statue of Robert E. Lee. And I've had several conversations with people who are horrified at the thought of Monument Avenue being altered. And I have one friend who told me, well, I can remember walking along Monument Avenue with my father and being quizzed about the Civil War, and what a fond memory that is. And I understand that, and I felt the same way when I lived there. I loved jogging and jogging by those statues and seeing all of those statues. I'm a history geek. Of course I love the statues. On the other hand, as I told my friend, well, try to imagine you're your age and you're walking along with your son and you're black. It's not a very welcoming thing. And again, this is on the public streets. This isn't a private school. This isn't a private institute. I think it would make you feel pretty unwelcome. And I don't think sticking an Arthur Ashe statue in the middle of all of this is really going to change that. So I understand how both sides feel about these statues on Monument Avenue. Part of me would be very sorry to see them taken down and moved somewhere else. And part of me would feel that that's kind of something that we owe to the citizens of Richmond, if we're talking about those of us in Richmond. That it's too egregious a slap on too many people's faces to have them to contend with that. Anyway, as I told you, then I wasn't stalking Robert E. Lee, but then I end up in Washington and Lee University. And that was the time I really got to experience living in the South. It's a different world. Of course, Richmond was the South, but Washington and Lee was a small southern town. And I saw the good, the bad, the ugly with all of that. The good, of course, is it's just an astoundingly beautiful area, and I miss it. You know, I miss living in the Blue Ridge Mountains. I can remember sitting out at night when there would be a thunderstorm and just listening to the reverberations. I also miss the pace. You know, in a lot of ways, I feel like I'm more like those who live in the South than those who live in the North. I've been here a long time in Philadelphia. I was a public defender, so it's hard for me to even remember the slower pace that I once lived in, but I think that's my natural pace. Hey, I love baseball. And people say, well, we got to speed it up. I say, why? I don't need to speed it up. It's a good pace for me. I like baseball the way it is. One of the big differences between the North and the South has always been, was back when Thomas Jefferson was around, that the Southerners say, well, the Northerners are just obsessed with money. And we're more obsessed with land, family, God. And I think that's still true. There's less watches in the South. There's less economic competition in the South. There's less rushing around in the South. There's more class distinction in the South. Of course, I was in Washington a long time ago now. So I may not be talking about what that town is today. I was there in a time before the internet was really out. I felt like in a lot of ways I dropped off the face of the earth. I remember I lived in Los Angeles for about a year, and we're driving out from Los Angeles to Lexington, Virginia, and I saw this kid out selling newspapers in a park, and I thought, who lets their kid stand in a park? You'd never do that in Los Angeles. But there he was. And then I realized, oh yeah, I'm in a different kind of place out here. You know, right now my son is reading To Kill a Mockingbird, and I'm trying to help him understand this incredible book, and we're talking about the story of children looking at their town and seeing it revealed to them, and believing the town is just this beautiful, idyllic place on one level, and then slowly but surely, like a onion and peeling off the layers, seeing what lays behind it. And it's not a horror movie. It's not that everything is wrong in the town. But a lot's wrong in that town. And the poignancy of that book is seeing it through the eyes of a child who can't understand, why would there be racism? Why would we treat this fellow in a different way from another fellow? And, you know, I love the character of Jem because he feels it all the most but can articulate it the least. It's hard for him to explain why it's so upsetting. It's this feeling. And You don't notice a lot of things at first. I was in Lexington for about 4 years, and it wasn't really till the end that I was able to perceive a lot of things that I'd missed, because I was in law school for the first 3 years, so I'm in my own world and with a lot of people who aren't from there as well. But my fourth year, I worked at, I just had my daughter, Mikayla. And boy, it was an idyllic place to have a child. I mean, I would walk her over to VMI and walk her around these beautiful hills. And, the little old ladies would run up the steps and open the door. And, oh, isn't she a beautiful little girl? And I would take her to get her an ice cream cone. And, you know, very different than if I'd had Mikayla here in Philadelphia and you couldn't park and you really, it would be much more difficult. So that was one of the happiest years of my life, although we're in the recession. George Herbert Walker Bush is president at that time, and not a lot of jobs out there. So I'm working at the Thrifty Inn Hotel. You know, they told me when I went to Washington and Lee Law School, they said, we have 100% placement. Everybody gets a job when they leave the law school. And it was true, but my job was, sifting through laundry at a hotel and handing out keys. But I did get a job. But I was actually pretty happy that year. Very happy, really. And I loved that town. You know, one of my favorite things about Lexington was that at the end of Christmas, you know how depressing it is when you have to get rid of the Christmas tree. Well, they have this great celebration out there where they go on this mountain and they throw all these trees in a big pile. Seems to be incredibly dangerous. These giant flames with trees all around, and this one little, fire truck with a like 70-year-old man sitting there. But they play bluegrass music, and people are drinking, and there's times like that. I just thought, well, I'm in the best place in the world. I love this place. So when people started having discussions this year about all of the controversies, I became kind of the person to say, well, listen, it's not all about race that the Southerners are concerned about here. they believe that they have a way of life. And they believe that their way of life is being threatened. And it's about a lot of things. It's about a different view of time, a different view of how people spend time. It's about what I've already, you know, said about the different feelings of time, the different paces people have. When I first got to Lexington, I would talk to somebody and the person would say, "You're gonna have to slow down a little. I can't hear you." You know, everything was a little calmer. Everything was a little slower. But to the Southerners, they would look at the Northerners and think, you know, these poor people, they're not connected to their land. They move around from this place to that place. And they'd think that's a sad. You know, we're connected to this land out here. Of course, when I'm out in Lexington, I'm meeting a lot of families who have relatives who are in the armed forces. I don't meet many of those in Philadelphia. Didn't meet many of those in Falls Church, Virginia, in Northern Virginia. But I meet a lot of them when I'm out in Southern Virginia. And that's a part of the South as well. You know, basic patriotism, different worlds. And these worlds came to a collision in the Civil War. And in a lot of ways, they are still bumping heads against each other. I was amazed by how much people loved Robert E. Lee in Lexington, Virginia. Because I thought, well, you know, it's Washington and Lee. You know, Washington's the other founder. At least he wasn't really a founder, but when it was in trouble, George Washington put money to help save the place. And I think, well, why aren't they as into George Washington? I mean, George Washington won his war, for one thing. George Washington did a lot of things that can be admired, but it's not George Washington. It's Robert E. Lee. You know, I told you I got these books by Douglas Salfa Freeman, and I heard that he used to go out and he would salute a statue of Robert E. Lee before he would begin writing his book each day. He'd go out and he'd salute it. Of course, he was also an editor of a newspaper in Richmond. So I admire him greatly for having a full-time job and still having the time to be a serious historian. And I admire him because he's a very good writer. You know, I love people who can write history in a way that is interesting and makes you turn the pages. And he definitely does that. He definitely does that. But I did notice one thing as I'm reading just the beginning of this, the foreword. Let me see if I can find it here. Here it is. I'm looking in the foreword, and I see, "Prolonged as my investigation has been, and puzzling as some of its problems have appeared to be, I have been fully repaid by being privileged to live, as it were, for more than a decade in the company of a great gentleman. A biographer can ask no richer compensation. Second only to that has been the satisfaction of meeting many grateful inheritors of the Lee tradition. In the dark period after the war between the states, the most glamorous memory of the South was that of the Confederate cause, whose finest figure was Lee. In his military achievement, Southern people saw the flowering of their racial stock. In his social graces, they beheld their ideals embodied. In the honors paid his memory, every one of Lee's former soldiers felt that he had himself received the accolade." Okay, so that's interesting. It's interesting to see it called the War Between the States. It's interesting to see him talking about the flowering of their racial stock, and that the highest compensation you can get is spending your time with a gentleman. So, I'm interested in reading this in part to really try to understand a little better this relationship many Southerners have with Robert E. Lee, although I think I get it to some extent. To a lot of people, this was the ultimate. Robert E. Lee was the personification of what the South reached in terms of almost, in their eyes, becoming their own country. And I don't think most of the people today who find him to be so attractive to them don't do so because they want to reinstitute slavery, because they don't like black people. I think there was a feeling of a different world, a pride that they felt from Robert E. Lee. And the fact that he kept winning battles against great odds and greater numbers. Of course, Lee understood better than many of them did that he really wasn't winning those battles. I mean, people were so delighted after Chancellorsville, but he understood that, well, what did I get out of that? I lost a lot of people. They lost some more people, but they have a lot more people. And if I keep winning battles like this, I'll lose the war. And that becomes part of the reason why he's going to take such risks, most famous of which being the risk he takes at Gettysburg, which doesn't work out. But he understands that he's got to gamble, because they're not going to defeat the North if both sides are fighting with all their people out there and all their people committed. But that's the problem Lincoln has to deal with. You know, Shelby Foote said that he felt like the South never had a chance to win, and that the North was fighting the war with one hand behind their back, and if they had needed to, they would have just pulled out the other hand. I don't agree with that. I think they could have won, because yeah, they're not going to win if everybody's fighting it all out, but the key is, how do you get your people to fight it all out? How do you convince people to go to battle for something like union, or to save, or to free slaves that you've never met, people that you've never seen? And for all of us who think we would do that, I don't know. I mean, I don't see people avoiding H&M very much, even though it's pretty well documented that their clothes are made by people living in virtual slavery. It's important to look at both sides of a conflict like this with a little bit of humility and a little bit of self-understanding. You know, Bob Dylan says, people, in one of his songs, he says, people don't do what's right, they do what's most convenient and then repent. And for those who say, well, how could Thomas Jefferson be such a terrible person as to have slaves? I think a lot of people do deeds that they know are wrong. A lot of people eat bacon who would never go to a slaughterhouse and see the conditions that brought that food onto their plate. And they don't want to think about it, because if they did, they wouldn't be able to eat bacon. It's very easy to live if you're in New Hampshire. It's very easy to live your life and have no involvement whatsoever with the question or issue of slavery. You don't have slaves. You're not holding any slaves. You're not participating in the process that's making people slaves. That's enough for most people. It really is. Now, Abraham Lincoln has to convince them to put their lives on the line over this. Ultimately, over this. War doesn't necessarily begin that way, with him saying it's about slavery, but it's going to end that way. And he's going to make pretty clear that's what it's about in his Gettysburg Address. It's an amazing thing that people were willing to fight and to die to make other people free. We know what the South's fighting for the most part. They're fighting, as one of the soldiers said, I'm fighting because you're here. You know, I'm fighting to protect my home. You're invading my land. Well, what's the North fighting for? That's where the brilliance of Abraham Lincoln comes in. Because he has to get people to the point where they're going to be willing to fight that fight. You know, I love giving tours about American history and particularly about the Revolutionary War, and I love discussing Thomas Jefferson. And to me, the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, they're almost like different parts of my mind, just the way I can enjoy baseball, but I can enjoy football. When I'm studying the Revolutionary War, you know, I'm reading Rousseau, or I'm reading John Locke, Jefferson. I'm reading all these political doctrines, and the Civil War is kind of a different thing. I don't think there are characters with the intellect that we have in the Revolutionary War that we're dealing with here, but that doesn't make them any less fascinating. You know, talking about people like Ulysses Grant, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, William Seward, Abraham Lincoln, Longstreet. I mean, these are interesting people in a different way. There's something about personal bravery that holds its own level of interest. Why couldn't this whole thing have been avoided? President Trump said. Well, we're going to talk about that in the first weeks, but I will say, I don't think it could have been. You know, the war, the first podcast is going to be about when this war starts, and when it starts is in 1787, when the North and the South draw the line, and it's made clear that, you know, the South's going to leave if they don't have 50% of the power. Even if they don't have 50% of the population, they feel that if they do not have 50% of the power, they're going to be overwhelmed by the North and enslaved, is what they would say. Forced to live in a different kind of way. Forced to be like the North. They don't want to be like the North. They don't want to have that obsession with money. And so they made it clear from that day. And to say, well, why couldn't we compromise? We did compromise. We compromised back then. We compromised with the Three-Fifths Compromise. We compromised when Jefferson purchased Louisiana by creating the line that went through it, that half would be slave and half would be free land. We compromised with the 1850 Compromise. And so if you're going to say here today in 2017, 2018, why didn't we compromise? And I don't want to just pick on these people in that are in political positions today. I think the person they heard this from first was Shelby Foote. He says that in the Civil War documentary. He says, well, it was just a failure to compromise. I would respond, every war is a failure to compromise. World War II, the American Revolution, the Vietnam War, you know, that's almost not worth saying. But when you say it that way, what you're doing is kind of, I think, creating a false equivalency and saying, well, these two people, you know, these two sides, they wouldn't compromise. They wouldn't work it out. They were both being unreasonable. Those who think this, those who say this, need to understand that a compromise would have had it that slavery is legal today. I mean, that's the only compromise that could have been possible. We would have had to create a constitutional amendment protecting slavery in the southern states, and we would have had to have a constitutional amendment, I think, saying that for every free state, a slave state has to be admitted. If that's the country you want to live in, then yeah, we should have compromised. But there does come a point when you can't compromise, and that's when war comes, and that's what happened in this case. No big mystery. You know, we compromised and compromised and compromised and compromised. And then there became a point where there was no more room to compromise. We're going to discuss it in the first podcast, but, you know, the South had fought and fought and fought to keep inequality between the states, and they realized, well, even though Lincoln's not taking the slaves away from the South, he's going to change that equality, and that's going to mean the end for us. Buchanan, President Buchanan, still searching for compromises, but those who put Lincoln in said, well, why are we compromising? We won the election. I don't think we should be compromising. So, as we look at the Civil War, my job is to try to look at it with honest eyes, and my job is to be as impartial as I can be. But, you know, impartiality is a myth. And this is a story. And it's a story with drama. It's a story that has everything that you can imagine. It's got drama. It's got pathos. It's got humor. It's got heroics. This is the greatest story, probably, that our country has produced. And as I grapple for objectivity, impartiality, I'm still going to tell the story the best way I can that really tries to bring these events to life. I mean, this is a hell of a story. What happened in the Civil War is something that goes both directions. You know, it goes backwards, and you can see the seeds of our Civil War conflict, which begin in the Constitutional Convention, and it goes forwards to this day, which is why we've had this discussion today. It's been a little bit of a somber, quiet discussion today, and I apologize for that, but that's how I get, I guess, when we're just talking about current events as opposed to history. It's why I've escaped living in 2017, 2018, and I live in the 1700s and the 1800s. I live in a time that I'm much more suited for grappling with. Wasn't necessarily better, as we'll hear. I mean, the Civil War is not a very pleasant time. It's full of horror. It's full of ugliness. It's full of pain. But I think what a lot of people are drawn to with the Civil War is that it's pain with a purpose. People felt on both sides of the conflict that they were part of a bigger struggle that was about the soul of their nation, whether it was the United States or the Confederacy. And they put their lives on the line in order to fight for the nation that they believed was the just and the proper nation. So thank you for spending the time with me to discuss this as we say goodbye to 2017. When you hear me next, it's going to be a new year, and we will be reconnecting with George Washington. We're going to do a couple episodes. For those of you who have not heard the earlier George Washington episodes, I certainly recommend that you do so. Listen to the first, I believe we've done four episodes on George Washington. And then we're going to, as I say, connect back in early 2018. And we're also, during the next month in January, going to have our first podcast about the Civil War, about many of the events which are going to lead us to this unbelievably costly war. So I wish you a happy new year, and I will see you once again in 2018.